I'd like to welcome everyone to session 105 on Replevin. We won't be using the projector and PowerPoint, so if you'd like to be a little closer to the action and move to this side of the room, you'd be welcome to do that. The internet, and particularly eBay, have expanded the number of buyers and sellers of historical materials, including government documents. Individuals and dealers find it much easier to market their wares worldwide, and it is simultaneously easier for archivists to find potential acquisitions for our collections. On some occasions, we find government documents for sale, and stolen documents also appear in the marketplace. Our session today looks at one aspect of this phenomenon, the issues related to the sale and recovery of alienated or stolen government documents. One means of achieving this recovery is through Replevin. Replevin is an extremely controversial subject. What is it? In very broad terms, Replevin is a legal action whereby one party seeks to recover property from a second party, generally at the outset of a legal proceeding. It can apply to private or public entities seeking the return of property, and some states have statutes which specifically address the ownership and return of government property. This seems relatively straightforward, but our speakers will provide some examples and discuss some issues which make Replevin quite contentious. Many archivists have a love-hate relationship with manuscript dealers. Some of us review their catalogs and online postings and occasionally purchase valuable editions for our collections. Sometimes the costs end up too high for our often limited budgets. If we work for public repositories, we may grimace a bit when we're outbid and a valuable resource we desire ends up in the hands of a private collector and may disappear from public view forever. The most disheartening scenario is when the item being sold is a government document and you're responsible for the archives in which you feel that document rightfully belongs. Recovering alienated or stolen documents through Replevin is a very broad topic, and almost every type of archival institution could be faced with this challenge. For more background on Replevin, I would recommend SAA's recent publication by Menzie Berndt-Klott, which has a chapter on the topic. Did I see Menzie out there? Yes, there she is. So ask her any legal questions about this. I'm an archivist. Archivists can even end up on opposite sides of this Replevin fence. For example, when a government document has ended up in a private historical society or university archives. Many situations like this seem to be worked out amicably or quietly. So today we will focus on where the real action is. Our session will look at government archives and primarily the Replevin of government or state records. This is where we sometimes get some fireworks. I should say also that Replevin is not so rare. Numbers may vary from state to state, but I rarely go 6 months without being notified by a staff member or a member of the public that a Pennsylvania state government document is being sold somewhere. The number of local and county documents similarly brought to our attention is much larger. In 5 years, we have attempted to recover 3 state documents, one successfully, one unsuccessfully, and one still pending in court. I will conclude this session by talking about some of the issues and lessons learned from these and other cases in which I've been involved over the past 25 years. First, I'd like to introduce our speakers, and we'll hear from them. One of our original speakers, Joe Klett, Assistant State Archivist in New Jersey, is unable to be with us today. Our two speakers are David Cheever, State Archivist of Maine, and Wayne Moore, Assistant State Archivist of Tennessee. Wayne Moore has served as Assistant State Archivist since 2000 and has chaired Tennessee's SHRAB. Wayne holds a PhD from the University of Rochester and has published several books and articles on Tennessee history, including the Tennessee Valley Authority. Wayne chairs COSA's Sale of Public Records Task Force, and his presentation will focus on their work. First, David Cheever will speak. He's the State Archivist of Maine. He has a very extensive background in the performing arts, in state government, television, and also the print media. So first, David Cheever.
Thank you, David, and good morning. Before we begin, the piece of paper that's going to circulate around is the primary subject of what I'm going to be talking about this morning. It is a reproduction of a copy of the Declaration of Independence. This was delivered to the town of Pownalboro, Maine, in 1776, and Pownalboro subsequently became better known as Wiscasset, although Pownalboro still exists. It was in the town of Wiscasset's possession and actually never really left the town. I'll get into that. But it became the subject of a replevin fight that a year ago, when we were kind of casting about in Atlanta for possible topics for this conference, I just mentioned to Melanie Sturgeon, I think, that we could talk about replevin because we were in the middle of the fight in court and we had actually lost in the lower court in Virginia. Again, I'll get into that in a minute. But this is a document, or a copy of the document, over which we were fighting. And you'll see some of the properties on it, including the intended recipient, the Reverend Thomas Moore. And you will see the creases that indicated that it was folded in a manner that was consistent with public documents at the time, and it was held by the Wiscasset town clerks over the passage of time all the way up into the 1990s. Again, details that we can get into further if you'd like, but before we begin, there are a couple of housekeeping items that we probably ought to address because they do influence the approach that we will take. First, it might be helpful, and I'm kind of thinking that this is a good audience to look at, to know how many people here have or contemplate having replevin laws on their books. I mean, Maine has one. And Nancy, you got it in? What was in process a year ago in California? Good. Well, we're still in the hunt. And again, regardless of whether the document in question is, and in fact, when we were in Atlanta last year, I got word that a library on the coast of Maine had gone up in flames, had been struck by lightning, it hadn't been properly grounded, and what we did not know at the State Archives was that the library had been holding a trove of state ferry records that connected, that because the state ran the ferry, connected the island to the mainland, and those records went up in flames. And had we known, and though it was a public library, it was being run by a private association, and that might have been something that we could have done something about, but whether it was a case of state ferry records or, in the case here, the Declaration of Independence, the idea of whether public possession of a public document is a good thing, whether it's a fight worth taking. The answer to the second question is good to know because, although it wouldn't have been terribly helpful to me when I became state archivist, because the fight for that document had already been joined. And for those of you, and I know Wayne and Jim worked a long time together, but Jim Henderson, when he retired, one of the things he neglected to mention on the way out the door was, oh, by the way, Dave, you got this court case pending. So all of a sudden we started receiving bills for it, and what? And it had been quiet up to that point, and then it exploded. As David said, it can get contentious, and it had. Anyway, I didn't really have a choice on the replevin case, and at least not the way I saw it, and ultimately I don't think I would have chosen to do anything differently. Initially, which was last year, the prospect of standing before you and talking about replevin was mildly intoxicating. At the time, we were fighting the good fight, trying to recover the declaration, and it looked as if our chances of prevailing in court were pretty good. For one, and this is something that we were very comfortable with, We had the preponderance of evidence, circumstantial and otherwise, on our side. We were satisfied, for one, that as one of the controlling measures, that the Declaration of Independence was a public document. It had been, after all, sent by government order to a town in what was then Massachusetts and was now part of Maine. There it was read by the Reverend Thomas Moore to a congregation on a Sunday in October of 1776, and for all that anyone could prove, there was where it had stayed from the time it was read until 1991, when it was discovered in an estate sale. We did not become aware in the state of Maine of its existence, however, until tipped off by two anonymous calls in the mid-1990s. Then the search commenced. We didn't know where the document was. We knew who had picked up the properties engaged in the estate sale. But tracking down the documents, finding out where they'd gone, it was a double transatlantic venture. And Maine, as you may know, is not a rich state. And sicking our investigators on this from the Department of Attorney General, it was not something that they could do. And this is essentially pre-internet. And they were doing a lot of footwork trying to find out what happened to this thing. So, you know, they weren't going to get on the plane and head over to London to find it, but they were pretty sure that that's where it went, came back, went back, and ultimately wound up back in the city of New York. Anyway, I can keep going because it's a fascinating story. But instead, let's get to the Replevin issue. Once apprised that the copy existed and it was being shopped, the state of Maine relied on its Replevin law, granting the state, as David was saying, the authority to pursue instances when public documents wind up in a commercial environment. We were going to try to get the document back. Our Replevin law was an outgrowth to the Maine Archives enabling legislation. We notified the individual who sought to own the declaration that the state and town wanted it returned. Now, we had to notify the individual through that individual's attorney, because the individual's identity was not known. It was a John Doe request to us, or notification of us, and it was, by response, a John Doe reply, because the individual wanted to remain unknown for a variety of reasons. Anyway, the process had worked before. In fact, the process had worked before with the same dealer, involving, ironically, another copy of the Declaration of Independence of another town in Maine. And we thought, at the very least, because we were dealing with the same dealer, and because that initial copy for a town called North Yarmouth had been returned without incident, it was one of those amicable settlements where when the individual who sought to own it became aware that it was a document that the town wanted and that the state was willing to pursue, said, hey, you know what? Okay, so we now have that copy. This turned out differently. The dealer and the collector responded in a different fashion. The collector spurned our request. Instead, he sued Maine to gain clear title to the document. As many of you recall, and as I mentioned, he prevailed in lower court. Not to worry. This was my not to worry face. In Atlanta. Not to worry. He prevailed in lower court. We got it taken care of. The judge's ruling was so flawed in Fairfax County Court in the Commonwealth of Virginia that the state of Maine was again confident that we would prevail on appeal. That's what we thought. The Virginia Supreme Court, to our chagrin, affirmed the lower court's decision. Maine lost. And I hazard the view that in a way we all lost. But in losing, there are things to be gained, and that's why I'm here. First, so we're all clear, there are a couple of things that this case was not and is not. And as we wrestle with Replevin as a concept and debate its role as a tool for meddlesome governments, a distinction may be made. The document in question, which is now being circulated, holds little research value in asserting its Replevin claim. Maine noted that the Declaration is, frankly, an historic document. We were not seeking to deprive anyone of an opportunity to plumb the depths of any author's philosophy or rhetoric. Nor is this case an attempt to deprive anyone of an opportunity to make a dollar. We weren't looking to foist a financial loss onto someone who we could only presume was acting in good faith. In fact, we were confident that whatever money had been brought into this mix could be recovered pretty easily. No, this was a case where we believed that a public document belonged to the public, that it was not for sale, and that it should not be for sale. As an aside, in making that distinction afterwards, my email inbox was pelted. Transmissions from people who practically brayed that the mean old state of Maine got exactly what it deserved. Maybe so, although that logic kind of escaped me. I did have some interesting exchanges, though. I think I've seen some of these people on TV in recent weeks. But again, that may be one of the reasons why we're having this session. So, did we learn anything in losing the case? More to the point, did we learn anything from losing that we can apply next time for ourselves and learn anything that we may be able to impart to you that your replevant fight will end as it should? For starters, how about a line from that classic American film, The Wizard of Oz? As Dorothy remarks, there's no place like home. The Deputy Attorney General who oversaw Maine's case did not mince words at the conclusion. He called the decision rendered in the Commonwealth of Virginia a home job. The plaintiff is a resident of Fairfax County there, and that is where he filed his lawsuit. It is fair to say, and it happens too often to deny it, that it certainly appeared to us that the court wanted to find a way to help one of its own citizens. Amazingly, but not, I guess, surprisingly, it went out of its way to do so. Annoyingly, too, I might add. Anyway, the question was how to do that. In calm reflection following the decision, we concluded that a Maine court would certainly have interpreted Maine law the way we believed to be correct. The same could be said for Virginia's courts. If a Virginia interpretation of Maine law happened to work in a Virginian's favor, well, case closed. Another factor which in these times cannot be overlooked is the financial burden. Our Department of Attorney General works fine in the state of Maine. In fact, they don't charge us for the work they do in the state of Maine. To work in Virginia, however, required the hiring of local counsel. Even hiring local counsel on the cheap, and we began to wonder whether we were getting what we paid. But they had a nice reputation, and we paid the bill. Anyway, much as we might wish otherwise, our pockets are not as deep as at least the private collector in this instance. He, even before the economic crunch, and after, for that matter, he was a dot-com billionaire, and he was willing to risk a small fortune to make his case, and we spent a small fortune trying to make ours. In many ways, considering the outcome, it would have cost much less for us to have the case tried at home, obviously. And in hindsight and in foresight for any entity looking to bring a replevant case, the advice from here is to fight the battle on your home turf if you can do it. States tend to respect their own laws. And we offer they might not look as kindly toward laws from away. On another point, from my time working in the Attorney General's office, I can claim that there is truth in saying that if you don't have the facts in a case, you argue the law. And if you don't have the law in the case, you argue the facts. In this case, there was no question. There was no question. The facts were overwhelmingly in our favor. You could not look at the facts of this case and conclude differently. Oh, that didn't stop the attorney for the collector from posing that the facts could be seen in another light. But even the court in Virginia did not want to mess around with the facts, although it did tweak one, which I'll get to in a second. Anyway, rather than accept the facts as defined by Maine law, the Virginia court took the case to a different place. Without actually, and this is another distinction, without actually entertaining any argument about it, the justices decided that Maine's law was flawed. Now, mind you, The attorney for the collector did not raise this issue. It was not argued in court, which had our people more than baffled. The court decided that Maine's law was flawed, and not the Replevin law. The Replevin law was fine. No, what was amiss was Maine's law establishing the Maine State Archives. The law was enacted in 1965. The Supreme Court for the Commonwealth of Virginia decided that, at least in this case, Maine's archives law did not pertain to the town of Wiscasset's copy of the Declaration of Independence. In fact, because our attorneys failed to emphasize the legislative intent behind the enabling legislation, the court decided that Maine's archives law did not pertain to any document created before 1965 that Maine wished to claim as being archival. You can imagine our reaction. I think your reaction might have been the same. It then stood to reason by the court's view that if the underlying law is flawed, then what followed it and was built upon it was also flawed. Thus, it didn't matter that the Replevin law was solid. The fact that the enabling legislation for the archives they viewed as being flawed, if the document occurred before 1965, ta-ha, too bad for you. My advice here is to check, for those of you who have legislation on the books, check the enabling legislation to ensure that it says what you believe that it says and that it covers the material that you believe needs to be covered. We're going back to fix ours. We have to. We have to have a clear legislative intent and be prepared to defend that boldly in any case that goes forward. And allow me to underscore another element. Being sure that you have the legislative intent on your side covers the whole. Because if they're looking for something, that's a big piece. The judgment of legislative intent. Make sure it's on your side. Anyway, once Maine's law was out of the way, the nature of the case, our Replevin case, was changed. The court's finding on the applicability of Maine's archives enabling legislation changed it so that it became a common law dispute. That alters the burden of proof, for one thing, and it tilted the scales of justice even further for the plaintiff. The court, under the common law, challenged Maine, the defendant, to prove that the town of Wiscasset had never relinquished ownership of the document. We regarded that as moot. After all, the town had accepted the declaration and had housed it, and we were surely going to assert that as a significant historical document, it belonged to the public. Here's the tweaking thing I mentioned. The court said not so fast. The document, as you see on the back, has the markings indicating its intended recipient, the Reverend Moore. And the document was considered by the court as being legitimate and alarming in a way that an invitation to treason can get your attention to the residents in 1776. Yet, the court decided that because Ezekiel Russell, whose name appears at the bottom of the front of the page, was a commercial printer and had printed the copies for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, well then, the Wiscasset copy was not a government document. Never mind that to thus trivialize and devalue the document in court was, in essence, to call into question how anyone, most notably the plaintiff, could prize it as he had in attempting to buy it for $470,000. The court's position was not to question the commercial judgment of the transaction. It was merely to determine whether the transaction involved something that could, in fact, be bought and sold. Russell printed 250 copies for distribution to the organized Massachusetts towns and cities. 11, maybe 12, we hear rumors of a 12th, remain. As another aside, you may recall seeing the July 2nd story out of London. Another copy of the Declaration of Independence was found in the British archives. That copy is a Dunlap copy, as opposed to a Russell copy. There are only 200 of the Dunlaps. No one's come forward to say how the copy, the Dunlap copy, wound up in the British Archives or whose copy it might have been, speculation abounds. But we in Maine were confident that we knew, says right on it, for whom the Russell copy was intended and who then should be its rightful owner. That was our case. And to give the collector some credit, he found something he wanted. He paid a steep price for it, and he is willing to pay to defend his purchase. And every dime that he spent defending that purchase enhanced the value of the document in the marketplace. But he was not willing to fight on our turf. He preferred his own. And as anyone who understands the tactics of war, an entrenched foe defending ground of his choosing is five times more difficult to defeat. Now, it might not have made a difference. We will never know. But Maine showed up for battle with no reinforcements. Perhaps it was complacency. Perhaps it was oversight. Perhaps it was ignorance. We fought our battle alone. We were pretty sure that we were going to win. We had the facts. We had the law. How could we lose? No other state, nor any allied institution or association came forward to voice support for Maine's claim. There was no cavalry riding to the rescue, in part because we didn't think we needed any. This was a case regarding the rightful possession of an original copy of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence. The collector had it. The town of Wiscasset wanted it back. So did the state of Maine. But rather than being a rallying cry for those whose professional and personal commitment lies in protecting public documents, it remained the word of a single state, small as we are, mewling about Replevin against the intent of a private citizen to buy what he wanted where he wanted. The decision in Virginia went for the individual collector against the individual state. And as I said, my email inbox was bombarded with people going, ha, 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 to you. We look upon the outcome as wrong on several levels. Alas, short of trying to buy it, there's nothing that we can do to get the declaration back. Furthermore, the ruling does not negate Maine's Replevin law, but it has sent us back to work to close those holes and to tie up any of the loose ends that the court seems to have uncovered. The decision also made us that much more resolved that the battle is worth waging. We could not let the Declaration of Independence go without a fight. It was a fight we should have won. And in this, the 75th anniversary of the National Archives and Records Administration, it would have been a good one to win. And on that, I shall cede the floor. I'll be glad to take any questions later. Thank you.
Well, the title of my paper is Selling Government Records, Forging a Partnership Between Dealers and Archivists. I will begin with a disclaimer. I'm neither an attorney providing legal advice nor speaking today as an official representative of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Obviously, the best way to eliminate the sale of government records and resulting Replevin issues is to prevent any of our archival documents from leaving government control in the first place. So our first job as archivists is to get the appropriate records into the archives and then to keep them there. Both of these tasks are much easier said than done. The first step, of course, is a records management program which appraises records as archival and captures them for the archives. And then the second step is to provide good security and keep them there. However, there are many issues beyond our control, and the problem of alienated records and stolen government records are far beyond our control in many situations. In some jurisdictions, records walked away or were stolen years before an archives even existed. And these records remarkably reappear over and over and over again. Perhaps a corrupt official a century ago discovered they could make a buck by selling the early records of their office, such as someone in Pennsylvania did with our copy of the Bill of Rights. Little aside here, there were 14 copies of the Bill of Rights made in 1791, sent to the 13 colonies and one kept by the Congress. Nine states have their copies. One sent theirs back to Washington, and three are missing. One of those is Pennsylvania's copy. The other copies belong to Georgia and New York down here in the front row. We think it's our copy that's in the New York Public Library, and when I go talk to our new archivist of the United States, give Pennsylvania back its copy of the Bill of Rights. You told me you'd lost yours, and New York burned theirs up. Some officials decide to ignore their retention and disposition schedules and take their files home with them when they leave office. And of course, as all of us know, even the very best security measures cannot prevent all thefts, especially the rare occasions of employee theft. And I see a couple heads nodding in the front row, and that's happened to me too. So dealing with replevin is likely to become a part of your job in running any government archives. Good records management and security will minimize lost records, but never eliminate the problem. Why is replevin such a contentious topic? Archivists see replevin as recovering what is rightfully public property. Dealers see replevin as an abuse of government authority and a taking of private property. So we may not be on the same page at all with some manuscript dealers. I have six suggestions to lessen the tension. First, since this is a major point of contention, clearly draw the line between government records, which should be in public hands, and those which should be in private hands. Use brochures such as those produced by NARA and Tennessee to educate the public and dealers about the definition and value of public records. A license, a deed, or even a letter issued or sent from the government to an individual or a business is a government record, but it's also a document produced in the course of official government business, which is immediately delivered to and intended to be in private hands. However, then you have those bound volumes which record and contain the government copies of these deeds or these licenses, and those should remain forever in government hands. And they should, of course, be transferred to the archives as soon as their administrative value has passed. When such archival documents are taken from government possession and come on the market, we have a duty to recover them for the public. But not every government record stays in government hands or belongs in the archives. Second, pick your battles wisely when you find a government record being sold. Unfortunately, economics determine that we cannot pursue the recovery of everything. Replevin is expensive, as our previous speakers have mentioned, and your legal resources may be limited. At the state level, you don't want to wear out your welcome at your Attorney General's office. Logistics make it virtually impossible to pursue documents from one state which are being sold in another state, especially if their value is relatively low. And David talked quite a bit about that already. An interesting question is, what would it take to create both a commitment and the legal structure whereby the Attorney General of each state would represent the state archives of any other state pursuing recovery of a document in their state? This is probably far too complicated and idealistic to become reality, but we should raise the issue with the National Association of Attorneys General. My guess is David would have had a better shot in his case if instead of a private attorney, the Attorney General of Virginia had been representing him. Whether that could ever happen is a major question. Third, be prepared if you enter into a replevin case for very significant fallout and try to lessen it. One part of this preparation is to be ready for the tactics you will face when you initiate a replevin action. Those who sell government documents may try to link replevin to that ever-popular government procedure known as eminent domain. We must emphasize that there is no comparison between these two. We are seeking to recover government property and not to take private property. This is a point about which some manuscript dealers will vehemently disagree. The issue is best illustrated with some examples. Alienated or stolen government records sometimes never see the light of day again. Other times they change hands very quickly and frequently. In a large theft in 1988 from the Pennsylvania State Archives, hundreds of documents were taken by one patron. He was caught, and many of the documents were recovered. But between one and two dozen documents, we estimate, were not recovered, and the thief died in a car accident before providing any information on which of these documents he had sold and to whom he had sold them. We have been able to trace a handful of them, and they had sold in a couple occasions even two or three times in the 12 months following the theft. One document we identified went from a dealer in Pennsylvania who bought it from the thief to another dealer in Florida and sold back to another dealer in Pennsylvania in under 3 months after the theft. In these cases, the last individual in possession of the documents, when the authorities track it down, is left to fight the legal battles to keep it. And they invariably argue that their purchase from the previous owner was legitimate. If they lose, their only recourse is to try to recover their purchase price from the previous owner, and of course that entails more and more legal fees. The key point for government archivists is that no matter how many times a document has changed hands, it does not negate our basic argument. Archival state records are not private property. A private individual should not buy, sell, or own government records. And once property is stolen, it remains stolen property, no matter how many more times it has been bought and sold. Dealers and their attorneys are quite ingenious in trying to void this basic argument. You will often hear the claim that a document was purchased from another legitimate dealer, so its purchase must have been legitimate. Another common takeoff comes from the concept of a statute of limitations. After being taken from government possession, as I indicated, a document may be sold several times very quickly, or it may sit for 20 years in someone's house or even in a dealer's shop. Dealers argue, how can the government try to recover something which went missing 50 years ago? Again, our argument is that once an archival record, always an archival record. Once it's stolen property, it's always stolen property. Dealers often resort to another argument, which has more legitimacy and is more difficult for archivists to overcome. It usually doesn't work or apply in cases where you have clear evidence that the documents in question were physically stolen from the archives. What if you cannot absolutely prove the archives had the document? In other words, you don't have a detailed inventory or microfilm showing the document. The dealer may then argue that the document left government hands decades or even centuries ago. Or even more likely, the dealer will argue that the government officer or agency possessing the documents threw them out or they gave them away. It's very difficult to prove that something did not happen in this case. And we have to admit, documents are occasionally obtained through dumpster diving. But I think more often than not, dealers and their attorneys have learned that this is an excellent claim to muddy the waters in these cases. Here is where it helps to have a strong state law, which indicates private ownership of public documents is not permitted, regardless of how they were taken from state custody. My final three suggestions focus on improving relations and reducing disputes between dealers and government archivists. First, manuscript dealers should drop their widespread insistence on anonymity for buyers and sellers. The Manuscript Society's Code of Ethics emphasizes that members have an obligation to provide clear title, to avoid selling stolen documents, and to authenticate what they sell. My question is, how can dealers achieve these standards if they refuse to reveal from whom they acquired a document or to whom they sold it. Last year, one of our 1988 stolen documents was sold by a West Virginia dealer. We accidentally discovered it in an online catalog 6 months after the auction. When we contacted the dealer and informed him that he had sold a stolen document, he refused to provide either the name of the person who had consigned it to him or to whom he had sold it. The dealer did follow up on our request and contact the buyer, who indicated they wanted to remain anonymous and that they had already sold the document again. So without multiple subpoenas, which our attorney general said were basically impossible to obtain for a $1,000 stolen document in another state, we reached a complete dead end in this case. This lack of cooperation from dealers is extremely frustrating and appears to conflict directly with their stated principles. Revealing sellers would help establish provenance and perhaps occasionally even catch a thief. And revealing buyers would help recover alienated or stolen government records. Obviously, this issue applies equally to dealers selling stolen non-government records. I should confess that I believe some dealers are either knowingly fencing stolen documents or simply looking the other way. How did all those dealers in 1988 think our thief had suddenly obtained all those Revolutionary War documents? And simply saying my grandmother found them in the attic isn't an answer that dealers should accept. Maintaining anonymity without a subpoena or a court order seems inconsistent with a pledge to provide clear title and not to sell stolen documents. Our most interesting replevin case in Pennsylvania is still being litigated. Last fall, we were notified that a Philadelphia dealer was selling an 1840s state penitentiary record on eBay. Our attorney contacted the attorney general, who contacted the state police, who put in a preemptive bid and actually won the document on the eBay auction. But a few hours after the eBay auction closed, the state police also showed up at the dealer's store in Philadelphia with a search warrant and seized the document. They didn't want to pay the eBay bill. But winning the document in the auction is an interesting tactic because it allowed the auction to play out. So it kept eBay out of the issue, it kept third parties out of the issue, and it was actually, I think, a good tactic to go ahead and let the auction play out and buy the document, even though they had no intention of paying for it. The dealer then, because we seized the document, also had to sue us to get the document back rather than vice versa. And this, of course, is another important tactic which is only available when the document is being sold in the same state as the archives. This would not have worked if our document had been down in Virginia or West Virginia. These events, of course, did result in an absolutely and still furious dealer, whose main defense is that he purchased the document from another Philadelphia dealer in 1999, and they both have every right to sell government documents. They are also arguing that the record book could have even been taken from state custody over 150 years ago when it was created, long before the archives existed, and thus cannot be claimed by the archives. And you heard that in David's paper as well. And in fact, we had a preliminary hearing before a one-judge panel in our Commonwealth Court, and he basically accepted that argument that if it could be proved that the prison book was stolen or taken from the state before the archives was created in 1903, that we would have no claim for it. It turns out that this book is part of a chronological set of three books. The other two actually came to the state archives in 1970 when the prison closed, along with hundreds of other items from the century and a half old prison. For our next step in this case, we set out to discover when and how the book left state custody. Of course, we had to subpoena the dealer selling the book last September to get the name of the dealer who sold it to him in 1999. Then we had to subpoena that dealer to find out where they got the book. None of them would give us that information voluntarily. But we did obtain the name of the person who actually had given the dealer three state prison books to sell in 1999, and we tracked her down and deposed her. She said her boyfriend, who had worked for the prison, gave her the book in the late 1960s, and she had had them in their attic for the last 30 years, and in cleaning up decided to sell them. The woman and her boyfriend had split up years ago, and our efforts to find out more about the taking of these books hit a quite literal dead end when we learned in June of this year that the boyfriend had been deceased for several years. What can we conclude from this case? Obviously, you need a cooperative attorney general and a cooperative law enforcement, and the records must be physically within your state. Neither dealer would give up any information about the record book without a subpoena. The dealer selling the book last year argues that he acquired the book legally from the first dealer and thus has every right to own and to sell it. We argue that it is obviously a state record and it's obviously an archival record. There is no provision in our state law for such a record to be legally acquired by a private citizen. Will we win? Pennsylvania has no replevin law, and this will be the first case of this nature ever decided by our Commonwealth Court, so it will be setting a major precedent. We cannot definitively establish that the book was stolen, although it's quite likely that the boyfriend in this case did steal the book. So can we retain it simply on the basis that it belongs in the state archives as a public resource? If we lose, of course, I'll renew my appeal to the state legislature for a replevin law for Pennsylvania. There is one more lesson to be learned from this case. Ironically, it was the first dealer in 1999 who acquired the book who didn't perform his due diligence and asked the woman how she came to be selling three state prison record books. The second dealer should be angry with him, not with us. And this relates to my second point on relations with dealer. Archivists need to educate dealers to contact the state archives of the appropriate state whenever they obtain or are asked to sell a state or local government document, and, of course, the national archives when they're selling a federal document. This would seem to be much easier than having a document for which they or a client paid several hundred thousand dollars or several thousand dollars seized. And then they must, of course, litigate to get the document or their money back. I think most state archives are willing to serve as this sort of clearinghouse in this manner. I also have an incident which relates to this. 3 years ago, I was contacted by a Chapel Hill dealer regarding another one of our stolen 1988 documents, which they discovered in a California dealer's catalog. The Chapel Hill dealer immediately recognized it as a Revolutionary War document, which could have only come from our holdings. The North Carolina dealer made arrangements to have the document returned, and it was very helpful in this case that we actually had a microfilm of these records, which established absolute proof of our ownership and the theft of the document. The California dealer was even persuaded by a call from our very insistent state police to reveal from whom they had obtained the document. And it happened to be an elderly Philadelphia autograph dealer who had Alzheimer's and was liquidating his entire careers of unsold inventory. The state police paid a visit to his staff, asked for his records, but found no indication of when and from whom the stolen document had been acquired. Had he purchased it and other stolen documents directly from our thief before he died in the car crash in 1988? Had it been bought and sold several times? We'll never know. But we had a good outcome. We got our document back, and this incident shows how things could play out with a dealer who is suspicious of selling government documents and conducts due diligence and contacts the appropriate state archives. My third and final point about dealer relations is simply that dealers and archivists should work together. One idea, which I cannot claim as my own, is to set up a joint committee of dealers and state archivists, which would be notified whenever a member of the Manuscript Society is selling or buying a state or perhaps even a local government record. Expecting eBay to participate is likely unrealistic, as they have already refused to ban the sale of government records, and Wayne already talked about this a little bit. The vast majority of dealers are quite honest and concerned about their integrity. Such a committee would certainly have some very interesting discussions, though. I think we can work out something to minimize the sale of records clearly documented to have been stolen from an archives, but that's probably a minority of the cases. Where that proof of a theft is missing, and we don't know how or when a document was alienated from government custody, the dealers will most likely almost always want to continue with the sale. Government archivists just don't accept that state and other government records which have been appraised as archival should be bought and sold. Dealers do. Would a joint committee be able to mediate? I believe it's at least worth a try. Or perhaps I thought it was before seeing the announcement I distributed before the session from the dealer's journal, which basically I see as a call to war. In conclusion, I challenge dealers to reveal how they obtained government documents for sale and to notify their state archives when selling government documents. I've accepted an invitation to meet with the members of the Manuscript Society and their Replevin Committee in October. Of course, I call it the Anti-Replevin Committee. I think it's a more appropriate name. Please stay tuned. I should add one more important footnote here at the end. Much of my criticism and my recommendations not only apply to dealers, but also to many non-government archival institutions. Historical societies and university archives also sometimes have no qualms about buying or accepting a donated government record. Shame on you. I would encourage you to follow the same guidance outlined in my remarks and work with your government colleagues to reduce the sale of government records. Probably half of the Pennsylvania government documents brought to my attention as being up for sale were noticed by other archivists or historians who followed through and notified the state archives. We very much appreciate that level of concern and support. Better communication will solve some of the problems with the sale of government records. Following the steps I have outlined, dealers can become part of the solution instead of part of the problem. I assume there may be a few manuscript dealers in the room. I asked Chris to search people and look for tomatoes as you entered, but in case she missed any, I'll back up a little bit. But we're happy to entertain questions now for the remainder of the session, and we'll follow up. If you look on your schedule, session 205, back in this same room in about a half hour, we'll continue the discussion. Yes? The question is about the disposition of records which were scheduled for destruction, basically. And I think a number of us have a lot of experience with that in terms of dumpster diving. And I know one very important piece of advice that we followed and have given to other people is clearly stamp anything, whether you're destroying it or through recycling or just throwing it in a dumpster. Clearly mark it as being deaccessioned from the local archives or the state archives. You don't want intact documents falling into private hands. And I know in Pennsylvania our policy is we're not going to let any documents out of our hands without completely pulverizing and shredding and recycling them. Because we don't want things like that we appraised as not being archival out there muddying the water and falling into private hands. So that's one solution, is simply cut out dumpster diving completely.
Pat, I think the onus there is on the archives. If they don't do... if their disposal procedures are not ironclad enough to ensure the complete destruction of the records, then I don't think the fault or any liability lies with the individual. There's been some pretty high-profile cases of incomplete burning. City of Nashville was taking records to an incinerator, and they weren't really doing a thorough job, and people were rifling through and getting documents. And that's the onus there really is on the government, I believe, in not having thoroughly disposed of records.
I've also noticed over the years that this happens much more frequently with publications than with one-of-a-kind archival documents. If you have a library and you're deaccessioning books where you have multiple copies, very clearly stamp them or destroy them, because the next thing you know, 5 years later, someone will be offering those things you destroyed right back to you as donations. George is asking about all of the international issues relating to especially fine arts, returning the Elgin marbles and Nazi-looted art and all of that, if that's going to have any impact in this country. I'm not sure I have an answer for that question. Some of you will remember about, I think, 1992 or 3, the federal government passed a recovery of, I think, Antiquities Act, and it allows documents, I believe, with a value of $10,000 or more to be recovered through federal proceedings. And I'm not sure why Maine didn't try that or why wasn't relevant in your case, but it takes things out of the local courts or state courts in one state or another and puts them into federal court, where I believe the footing is a little more equal between the plaintiffs and the defendants. Yes.
Vicky's going to answer. Part of that relates to a total makeover in the website that's going to, I think, populate it much more densely with material and divide it up in a way that states will be able to contribute their portion to those issue-oriented parts of the website.
For the purposes of the tape, let me recount that the question is regarding some of the information which will be placed on the COSA website. So for those listening to the tape, go to the COSA website in a couple months. The question is about whether replevin laws in states commonly have safe harbor provisions which allow other institutions which might possess government documents, if they provide public access, to maintain those without them being seized by the government. Anyone choose to comment about whether their state's replevin law has such a provision? I know a lot of states simply choose to look the other way, and that's certainly true in Pennsylvania, with the Historical Society of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia having a very substantial holding of early Pennsylvania records. And, of course, they existed 100 years before the state archives existed, and that was actually quite useful for them to be collecting records before we had a state archives. California law has not passed yet. Kim?
The question was whether we had contemplated taking it to federal court. And I have made a note to ask when I get back, because as I said, when I got there, I got in the middle of things, and we are already through the Fairfax County Court trial of the case. And I'm not sure this doesn't present a second bite at the apple, is one of the questions I'm going to ask, because, again, there was a confidence bordering on complacency that we had the facts and the law under control and that we would prevail against this case brought in Virginia. So we didn't, there wasn't a case, the question was not raised to me about changing venue or even moving to from the state to federal court, but I'm certainly going to ask when I get back.
And I think one of the issues may there be related to whether you're prosecuting someone for the theft of the document or actually trying to recover the document. The federal law can pretty obviously be used to prosecute someone for stealing the document, but in your case, that wasn't quite the nature of what was going on. We did use that federal law in my previous position in 1995. We actually were unable to prosecute a case of employee theft similar to the one in New York because the state statute of limitations had run out and told, and so we were able to then, because some deadlines were missed by the Attorney General's office, proceed with a federal action because there was no statute of limitations, and it proved very helpful. So you had a question over here? Yeah, the question is whether civil actions could be pursued, and I think in terms of my expertise, you're getting well beyond my legal knowledge, but I think many of these actions actually are civil action when it comes to replevin.
And if you will, this is where I thought the Virginia Supreme Court was quite clever, because in ruling first that Maine's archives law was flawed, and then ruling that because the document had been produced by a commercial printer, never mind that the capacity to produce the document by a government print shop, there was no government print shop producing this document in the Commonwealth. So they said, well, I'm sorry, Ezekiel Russell was a commercial printer, ergo, it is not a public document, it was a commercial document. They said, cute.
Question back there.
Yes.
Thank you. I think that's a very good comment to end our session, that you know this is a very nuanced issue, and as I mentioned at the beginning of my paper, I think on some occasions we have as a profession overstretched a little bit in claiming some documents. Clearly, a letter from whether it was a governor or a president to a private citizen, it's a government record, but it was sent to private hands, it remains in private hands, and you really have no basis as a government archives to recover something like that. On the other hand, a letter sent to the government was intended to stay in government hands, and you need to be very careful in not overstretching. And certainly many of our government repositories also collect private manuscripts, papers, corporate records, and we work with dealers all the time in buying private papers that enhance our collections. So you're right. I think the bottom line here is we need to understand each other, cooperate, and work more together instead of in opposition. So, right. As I mentioned at the beginning, session 205 will continue in about 25 minutes in this room, and we'll continue this discussion of replevin. So if you're interested in further discussion, please stay. Thank you.